So, okay. Then? 80. When by the disposition of his heart, he becomes indifferent to all objects, he obtains eternal happiness both in this world and after death. He who has in this manner gradually given up all attachments and is free from all the pairs of opposites reposes in Brahman alone. So someone who wants to get very serious about devotional service then has to be able to, or has to practice this aspect, that one is indifferent to all the different objects. So now, generally, when we think of indifference, which has been practiced in the past, like we see that, you know, the brahmacharis will be indifferent to the ladies, or devotees will be indifferent to their families, or you know, different situations like this, then we actually see it's not indifference. It's actually we're not attracted, so we dislike, like that. So it goes the opposite. It's actually we hate, but not on a necessarily a very very organized fashion or something, but it's the opposite. Indifferent means there's no attraction, there's no repulsion. So it's just a matter of if it's favorable to use in Krishna service or has something to do with Krishna service, then we deal with it. And if we don't, then we don't deal with it. Like that. That's the point. So then that is the position that one is dealing with. It's just one sees something, and one sees it in relationship to Krishna. And then if it's one's position to engage it, then one does. And if it's not, then one doesn't. In other words, what will be useful for one's service and for the pleasure of the Lord. So it says here, in this matter, gradually giving up all attachments. So this is a practice, it's sadhana. One has to work at this. One has to understand this and then gradually work for this. It says, then he is able to reposes in Brahman alone. So only that person can actually come to the Brahma-Bhuta platform. And only that person then can actually come to the, you know, go beyond the Brahma-Bhuta platform to the platform of prema. Because if there's any attachment or aversion in the world, then one will get stuck in the world. One will not be able to situate oneself on the Brahma-Bhuta platform. And without that, then one can't cross into the spiritual platform. I mean, one's on the transcendental platform, but on the actual platform personal reality. Where one moves into the realm of service to the Lord. And otherwise, one will just be in the brink, the tathasta point. It means we've come from there, and the difference is we've fallen from there from not knowing the glories of prema bhakti. Because we did not have any natural attraction for Krishna, then, I mean, we have it, but we didn't take advantage of it. Therefore, because the position is choice is there, no one's going to be forced. Right? So then one doesn't know, one makes one's choice. And because we're not having that natural attraction, I mean, not exercising any natural attraction for Krishna, then that means that there is, it's not aversion.
Indifference
to Krishna. So indifference automatically then turns into impersonalism. So that from that platform, then we become attracted by Maya. And then Maya then brings us into this world. So the whole process of devotional service, why there must be conscious, that's why it said Krishna consciousness. It means sometimes devotees, which is true in the beginning, if we just chant, we just take prasad, we're just with devotees, that's good enough. Because from that one will get purified and one will hear. And one will see good example. But at some point, one actually has to become Krishna conscious. That's what the society is made for. That's why it's named Krishna consciousness. It says, for Krishna consciousness. International Society for Krishna consciousness means that we're supposed to develop Krishna consciousness. So that means consciousness means conscious. So that means we have to know that we have a goal and we're trying to get to that. And we have to be conscious of that at all times, at all places. Then, when one comes to the Brahma-Bhuta platform, then one will not be stuck on the platform of indifference. One is indifferent to the material world, but one will not be indifferent to Krishna. See, the problem is tatastha means we're indifferent to the material world, we're indifferent to Krishna. But that indifference to Krishna creates impersonalism, which naturally then creates attraction to the material world. So this indifference is only useful in relationship to the material world. That's why the whole process, this whole process that the ascetic uses, this process of jnana, is only to get one to the platform of Brahma-Bhuta. Beyond that, it has no meaning, it has no purpose. It's done, right? Just like you have a knife. A knife is there, you cut the vegetable. Once you're done, you don't use it to stir the sabji and then serve it and then eat everything and then wash the pots with it and then clean the counter. No, it has its purpose, it's finished. You cut the vegetables, now you actually get into cooking. And when you get into cooking, it has nothing to do with the knife. So this whole process of becoming indifferent to all objects, that is for the purpose of coming to the Brahma-Bhuta platform. There's no other purpose. Once one gets to that platform, then this process of jnana has no purpose. It's done its purpose. It's happened. So then one takes up one, because one has been trained to know that love for Krishna is the goal that we're trying to obtain. Then we will go beyond that platform. Right? For on the platform of indifference, we may not go. If we see something, we become attracted to it, then we'll go the path of the acharyas. You know, we see the great acharyas, that they are serving the parshads, they're serving the Lord. And we see that, and we're attracted to that, and then this way we become attracted to Krishna, then we'll go that path. But if we just see so many things going on, we're in the pure state, we're not attracted, but we're not attracted to the material world either, one can't remain in that tatastha state, you know, very long. It's just not a state one can maintain. So then, from there, because the Brahman platform can't be maintained, right? So from there, one falls. So that's the whole idea is it's used as a mechanics to get one to that platform. But once one gets to that platform, then one has to know what the goal is and go beyond it. So it's just a stage in one's going, a momentary stage. That one has come now, there's no attraction in the material world, one has come to that. And then from there, one has gone on. Then from there, one goes on, like that. So this is the platform that one has been here. So this language here reposes in Brahman alone, means we understand it means when it comes to the Brahma-Bhuta platform, but the whole idea is one is going to go to the Supreme Brahman. So reposing in Brahman alone means is only if we're in Krishna. You can't just repose in only the Brahman alone, because that platform didn't work for us in the beginning. It's not going to work for us now, right? Like that, it doesn't work for anybody. One has to understand that this Brahman means the Supreme Brahman. 82. Okay. All that has been declared above depends on meditation. For he who is not proficient in the knowledge of that which refers to the soul reaps not the full reward of the performance of rites. So now this means everything that's been discussed before. We could take it meaning in the discussion with, in discussion meaning with just what has been discussed just immediately. Means this ascetic attaining to the perfectional platform, and just in the last few verses, it can be discussing the whole life of the ascetic, or it can be meaning everything that's been discussed before. Right? So we understand. So for most, they'll take just the aspect of this attaining perfection. Or possibly they will take the whole process of the life of a sannyas. But it means actually all the varnas, all the ashrams, everything that's been described before. Because that is daivavarnashram, is that you understand what is the position. In other words, the Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur describes it, you have the hamsa. Hamsa means they understand they're not the body. And they understand that there is a, you know, the higher goal purposes in life. right? They're not interested in the material nature. But now, in that, we find that we have two bodies, the subtle and the gross, and those have to be engaged. So therefore, we see the nature of those bodies and engage them in the Lord's service. Right? So in other words, the Hamsa is the one who is actually performing properly the devotion, these activities of varna and ashram. Right? So the Hamsas come in two varieties. One that where they're detached from the material nature, one where they have the knowledge of detachment, but they haven't got the full realization. So then they follow the rules of the Grihastha Dharma and all this, and perform their activities there. But there's no interest actually in sense gratification. So all this actually replies before that, because otherwise you can't actually follow all these other things properly, unless you understand the knowledge of the soul. Like that. So the full reward of any rite is understood when we understand what is the soul. Who is the Lord? Who are we? What is the material nature? What is that relationship? Then you actually get the full benefit. And the full benefit means it detaches us from the material nature and attaches us to Krishna. That is the real benefit. 83. Let him constantly recite those texts of the Veda which refer to the sacrifice, those referring to the deities, and those which treat of the soul and are contained in the concluding proportions of the Veda, in other words, Vedanta. So, another one must always be thinking of and discussing the scriptures in relationship to what is proper activity, in relationship to the Lord, and all the different how he acts in the whole creation and the whole cause, you know, the whole material world and the whole spiritual world. Then ourselves as the soul, as servant of the Lord, what is our position, our relation, how we're not connected with the material world, and then the concluding portions of the Veda, which is the Vedanta, in other words, the philosophy. So in other words, the philosophy of Krishna consciousness, thinking of the Lord himself, thinking of us as his servant, and what are proper duties, what are our duties to be done, you know, sacrifice. In other words, the preaching mission and the different activities of sadhana and varnashram that apply to us. So that should be the constant discussion of the sannyasi. But here it's mentioning also is that we can understand someone who wants to go back to Godhead. This is for anybody. 84. That is the refuge of the ignorant, and even that the refuge of those who know the meaning of the Veda. That is the protection of those who seek bliss in heaven and of those who seek endless beatitude. Okay. So these discussions, even for the ignorant, this is the proper thing for them to be. This is what they should hear about. This is their refuge. They think it's something else, but it's this. You know, discussions about the Lord, his expansions, his activities in the spiritual and material worlds. The position of the soul. How he's not part of this material nature and he's a servant of Krishna, and the proper performance of sacrifice. So for the ignorant, then those who know the meaning of the Veda, this is their refuge. Then it is the protection of those who are interested to go to heaven, right? And for those who seek endless beatitude, then which would normally be thought of as the jnanis, but endless means can only mean the devotees. So, in other words, this is topics for everybody. The ascetic, that should be the main discussions, but these are also the should be the main discussions for everybody else. But until they get to that platform, then they may discuss more on the sacrifice or more on other aspects. But the purpose is to come to this platform of discussing these things, where one is always discussing the philosophy, the Lord, ourselves and its practical application. Right? The philosophy has to be practically applied. In that application, there's the Lord and ourself and the material nature. So we have to know how to apply that. So then you finished your rounds? So then one must discuss these things, how we apply it. Understanding the Lord and ourself as His servant, then we learn that through the philosophy. Now we have to apply that. So that's sacrifice. So that's the whole culture. That's the whole etiquette. That's whole the whole devotional process. So these things are everybody should be discussing. 85. A twice-born man who becomes an ascetic after the successive performance of the above-mentioned acts shakes off sin here below, and reaches the highest Brahman. Oh, I see. Okay. Thus, the law valid for self-restrained ascetics has been explained to you. Now listen to the particular duties of those who give up the rites prescribed by the Vedas. The student, 87. The student, the householder, the hermit, and the ascetic, in other words, brahmachari, grihastha, vanaprastha, and sannyas. These constitute four separate orders, which all spring from the order of householders. But all or even any of these orders, assumed successively in accordance with the institutes of the sacred law, lead to the Brahman, who acts by the preceding rules to the highest state. Yeah, so in other words, it's springing from the householder. That's why generally most all the different rules are explained in the householder ashram. But that doesn't mean that they're not followed. Certain things aren't followed by everyone. It means the grihastha specifically, the maintenance of his house, the dealing with the women of the house or the wife, his keeping of money, and so many rights that go because he feels he owns the house and has these different facilities, then those are specifically for the grihastha. But otherwise, all the other things, the cleanliness, dealing with guests, all these different things like this, that's for everybody. The Vedic literatures are very, sometimes they're very much considered contradictory by most academics. But actually, they're the most systematic, and they don't waste time discussing something that they don't need to discuss. Like we see here, as we've gone through now, we'll have gone through here, we're just almost finished with this, the whole section on varnas, is they've described this very systematically, going from what is the Lord's creation, down to Brahma's creation, down to how that has to do with the rules and regulations of what is right and wrong. Then they've described the time element, which is essential for understanding action. Then they've described what is the place of those who are by nature going to follow this culture given by the Lord. Then it explains that someone born in that place would be born according to the proper samskars. Then it goes one by one through the samskars, and in this way comes through up until now the ascetic. So it's been very systematic. And in that, it doesn't describe anything anywhere that it comes out at that point. That's the main place where it's used, but it'll be used by everybody. Right? Just like here, we're describing the ascetic. Ascetic is for the purpose of going to the higher realms. I should be going back to Godhead, but at least, you know, they're trying for Brahman or some higher understanding yoga practice like this. So now, the whole point is everyone in all four levels of ashram should be interested in Brahman. So all these rules apply to them. Right? If you want to be very serious about going back to Godhead, you have to be a little bit careful about not, you know, killing living entities and squashing them and just being completely unnoticing what's going on. But there may be, one is distracted by so many things. The how you say, one, in youth, there's so much, frivolous sports, and just one gets bewildered by that. The grihastha ashram, all the things that are happening there, and all the duties and all the responsibilities, one gets sidetracked and one doesn't actually see where one's walking. Right? It means whatever one is thinking is superimposed on everything. Yes?
You mentioned that you pointed the other day in Bhagavatam class, and I didn't get a chance to ask. sometimes devotees, you know, these mosquitoes, they'll squack them and they say, well, I know the story of Prabhupada when he flicked one accidentally or something and he, Hari Sari, he watched it land and he was asking, did it die? Mm-hmm. It was very much an anxiety. But then sometimes devotees say that, well, just like with scorpions and spiders and stuff, they're poisonous, so we should kill them. So you kill them before they kill you, kind of thing. Mm-hmm. What is the proper, what would be your opinion on that as far as whacking mosquitoes around?
Well, generally one just tries to create the situation that they don't, how do you say?
Bite you.
Yeah, don't bite you.
Mosquito coils and...
Yeah, yeah, and different things like that.
Mosquito nets.
Yeah, yeah. Generally like that. I mean, I think there was one place where Prabhupada mentioned they're attacking with deadly weapon, you know. You know, so that's the niti. Yeah. But that's the niti shastra. But higher than niti shastra is dharma shastra. So the niti is just, is on the platform of justice. That's why we see here, it means... You're called varnas, or it's just occupational ways. It's the way that you feed yourself, basically. Ashrams are the shelter in which your spiritual advancement is going on. It means you do whatever you do to maintain yourself, then you come back to your ashram, right? You go out and work all day, then you come back to the home. And that's the ashram. The workplace is not the ashram. Like that. The brahmachari goes out and begs and comes back to the ashram where the teacher lives. The vanaprastha goes out in the field and after they've cut the, you know, the grains and they go and pick up something from the field or goes to the market and when the market's closed goes and picks up a few things. Then he comes back to his ashram. You know, so like that. Then the that occupational maintenance of themselves, that is what creates the varna and also the aspects of the ashram. But the ashram is where the spiritual cultivation is going on. Therefore, we see here Namana Samhita, and whenever it's being described, you always see the ashrams are described first, because that has the substance in it. They're more important. Though the where one can situate oneself nicely in the ashrams has something to do with the varna nature. So then, to determine that, one needs to see that also. But the most important of the two is the ashram. That's why we see Prabhupada also, when he established the movement, he established ashram first. And he established it very, you know, strongly. And many times devotees will say Prabhupada didn't establish varnashram. But the most important of it, the Brahmins, you know, and all the four ashrams, that's the most essential aspects. He established management, he established how it should go on, he established businesses. So that's all one has to establish. Means the artists just serve the others, they help the others, like that. So it doesn't need separate establishment. So it's already done, but some will consider that it's not because they don't see a whole economic base going on. And you know, like that. They'll just see the economics of the varnashram system as the important. But actually, the economics is just so that the ashrams can go on. You know, it's just like in a temple. If no one would say, we have this temple, it has nice deity worship, the devotees are there, they're very happy, there's good association going on, good training is going on, but they're not economically very together. So no one would say, oh, we don't have a temple here. You know, because the essence is when a temple has good money and therefore good facilities and everybody's set up very nicely, then that's a good temple. No one would say that. It means the essential thing is the spiritual development. Then with that, naturally, you know, money and other facilities are necessary, but that's secondary. You know, I was just talking with one businessman came yesterday. He's a devotee from the Middle East. Yes, he does big business. He does business there and he comes to India to buy things and he works in a lot of countries there. And he was saying that, you know, in the 2 hours in the morning, he just does his sadhana and everything. And then at the work, he doesn't get it. He has computers and all that. He doesn't get involved in them because he knows they just suck you right in. So he hires people, they deal with all the computers. So he says that he knows other businessmen, they themselves get involved in all these things, and of course they make a bit more money. But in his mind, is, you know, he's already a good businessman's already making, you know, tons more than what he needs, so you don't need to make, a 1,000 tons more than what you need. He's making, 100 tons more than what he needs. That's enough. So he just this is what I do. And I do my sadhana. And then the balanced time, I do my business. And they have nice preaching programs going on. And he was telling me all nice things and about how businessmen deal and their mentalities and all this. And so here's a successful businessman. And he's saying, I don't get that involved because I want to be Krishna conscious. I'm involved enough. I take care of a family easily. And, with eyes closed, I can do that. Then on top of that, then so much is there, then it can be used for different preaching projects and all these kind of things. One doesn't, one only gets involved as much as one needs. And more than that, one kind of avoids. He's a little older, so he mentioned, when someone's young, then they may get overly fired up. But that's, I was talking with another devotee whose proclivity is business, and he's good at it. So it's kind of like, he's making the point, when you're younger, then you have to get things set up. You have to get the home set up and all your facilities and this and that. So you're working more. So all your money, your net from what you do, you generally reinvest in all these things. So there's no profit as such. Everything's just being reinvested and all that. And then, and then you set everything up. But he says, nobody who's a devotee, who's doing business, ever thinks that this is what I'm always going to be doing. They always think at some point, once the business is set up and all the facilities are set up for oneself, because it's hard work, naturally they want to be giving money for the preaching to the temples and all this. He says that's just, it means at least in his experience, himself and any other devotee who does business and is good at generating funds, he says they don't have that. But he says the problem is some devotees who don't understand business and how much work it is think that, if you go out and if in 2 weeks you're not turning in big bucks to the temple, you're in Maya. So he says you have to give some space because it takes time to set up the business and set up everything. But once it's set up, what are you going to do with all the money anyway? And if you're Krishna conscious, you can't go out and buy, 10 Rolls Royce for yourself. You can't do that. You set up what you need for that and your comfortable living. And after that, what money you... Because the nature is you have to make money. You know how to do it. You see an opportunity. You can't not take it. And it's just like, you have a kid and you have a Mangal Arati suite and no one's around. It's like he has to take it. It's like, it's prasad. It's there. So like that, they have to make the money. But then they don't want to keep it for themselves. But they want to give it, and they want to see that it's given nicely. So he was making this point. So the whole idea is that it's an ashram. Therefore, all these things that are the philosophical aspects that the sannyas concentrates on, they're meant for everybody. All the ashrams. Like that. And all the rules on washing your hands and mouth after you eat, and then seeing that others, if you have any dependents that they're taking care of, they get prasad. All these things, they're described in the householder, but that's meant for everybody. Right? So therefore, the householder, it's mentioned at this point here, is that everything's coming out of those rules. Right? All spring from the order of householders. Because what's happening is it springs from it, one, in the material world, because we've been in the material world since time immemorial. And since time immemorial, we've been interested in eating, sleeping, mating, and defending. So that's the purification of that naturally comes in the Grihastha Ashram. So you have to get trained properly as a brahmachari, then one can be a good Grihastha. Then, because that's not the ultimate goal, eating, sleeping, mating, defending, therefore then vanaprastha sannyas. And then how far you get? Nice. If not, next life. Then you go again. Then you're a higher level. Then you continue until then you may see that now someone is born, and then like some of the acharyas, Narottam Das Thakur, then at 12 he just goes off, or Raghunath Das, he just goes off. They just go like this. But this is, the end of the line. But yeah. But all the rules that are there are described for the householder, but that same culture applies for everybody. The same proper culture applies for everybody. Just like all the rules of study are described for the brahmachari. So that doesn't mean that the grihastha, when he studies, does something different. Right? The brahmachari learns from a teacher, he's submissive, he inquires, he renders service. The grihastha wants to learn, they have the same thing. They have to be submissive, they have to hear, they have to inquire, they have to be doing some service, you know, somewhere for Krishna. Like that, then they'll get realization. It's the same process. But you describe study for with the brahmachari. How to control the senses, study and all that. That's also described again with the vanaprastha nyas. And then all the daily little things and how you eat and how you keep your clothes and do all these different things. That is done with the grihastha. So it's very, I see. The Vedic explanations and are very, very clear. Then it says, all or even any of these orders assumed successively in accordance with the institutes of the sacred law lead to the Brahman, who acts by the preceding rules to the highest state. Lead the Brahmana, who acts by the preceding rules to the highest state. In other words, wherever you start, then if you're using the rules from before, you're acting on those, you'll get to the highest state. So it's when you move to the next, the rule stays, but any of the aspects that it's being done for a lower purpose is given up. Just like you have the Vedic rules, someone follows it for karma. Now when one comes to the platform of jnana, one still follows those, but one drops out the purpose of karma, the fruits of karma, right? Then this becomes nishkam karma. That, and then from there, then one may follow the rules for bhakti. So the same rules are there. Just like you have the rule how you serve prasad. Now, grihastha may be doing it for, relatives or just to keep peace in the between the families or for some other purpose. They invite over some big people, this and that. But when you move to the next level, when that's not the interest, then you're still going to serve prasad in the same way. You're still going to sit down people. You're still going to serve nicely in the same orders and all this. So the one teaching goes on to the next. You just have to know which ones are specifically for what purpose. That's all. But the principles, the foundational principles of each, just they build up on the next because it's a natural development. Study, then application, and then detachment. And then, then the full concentration on spiritual. It says, the Brahmana who acts by the preceding rules to the highest state. In other words, the devotee, they are the actual Brahmanas. Bhaktisiddhanta says, Bhaktisiddhanta makes this point. The only real Brahmanas are the devotees. So this means the devotee who acts according to this, then comes to the highest platform. Like that. But if the devotee doesn't follow, then they can do that in the beginning, but they should understand it'll be very hard to make great advancement. Because it is Krishna's culture. Right? It is Krishna's culture. We may say we don't care, we just absorb ourselves in Krishna. But then at some point, then what are you going to do when you find yourself in the same situation that Krishna himself personally is present? Right? Duryodhana doesn't like to, he is free from following the rules. But unfortunately, he finds himself in the same situation that God is present. And unfortunately, God follows the rules. And therefore, the relationship isn't proper. He can't relate with what God is doing. Right? When God comes to the material world, he follows the rules. Because, and what's going on in the pastimes here are what's going on in the pastimes there. Like we hear in Braja, the only difference between Gokul and Golok is that here you have the demons that Krishna kills, in Golok you don't. And in Gokul you have, the gopis have actual husbands. You can go up and touch them and pinch them and they're there. While in Golok, they're not there. They just feel they have them there. It doesn't say that, they don't, serve prasad in the same way, or, they don't do all these different things like this. That's the culture from there has been reflected here. So in its natural reflection, which is a perversion. The perversion is because we do it for ourselves. We're the enjoyer. But its natural reflection is the pure Vedic culture. It means being done to please the Lord. Then you take that and then you pervert it. So it's a perversion of perversion. Then you get non-Vedic situations. Or you get the more, materialistic, non-devotional sides of the Vedic culture that are not the real purpose of the Vedic culture, Just like it mentions meat-eating. The Vedic culture doesn't support or advocate meat-eating. But if someone's going to be a meat-eater, at least they should follow God's rules on it. But it's not recommended. It's not recommended. So this, one should know that reflection is what's there, and that's what God does. That's what they call it pastimes, right? We may say, well, he's God, he doesn't have to follow. He's God, he doesn't have to follow. But for the pastimes, he does. He does follow, because that's why it's called pastime. It's something to pass the time, And he's doing that with his devotees. You have to have something to do. There has to be some reason to be together with the devotees. Otherwise, they'll just all sit around and just smile at each other. Actually, smiling is an activity. So they'll just all sit around and that knowing look. Everybody's absorbed in Brahman. So like that. It's not... But the pastime is there. So these cultures are there. So therefore, the devotee actually can follow them because he does them for pleasing the Lord. He doesn't do it for pleasing the senses. That's the thing is, most take that the rules and regulations of dharma are for material artha, material kama, and material moksha, like that. But they're not. From dharma, then comes all the facilities for Krishna's service, and then kama, it's Krishna's kama, right? We perform preaching. From preaching, then so much facilities comes. We take all those facilities that come, that artha, and use it in the Lord's service. So he gets the kama. Right? It's him. It's his. He's the recipient of that. So the dharma artha kama, that is for him, not for us. Dharma, we do it for him. The artha then Lakshmi gives because she's happy. And then the kama is the Lord's kama. So that's the actual transcendental process. But in the material world, somehow or another, like they take out the cows. Cows then eat grass. Then they give milk, and they milk the cows and give the milk to Krishna. Like that. 89. And in accordance with the precepts of the Veda and the Smriti, the housekeeper is declared to be superior to all of them, for he supports the other three. As all rivers, both great and small, find a resting place in the ocean, even so men of all orders find protection with householders. By twice-born men belonging to any of these four orders, the tenfold law must be ever carefully obeyed. Yeah. Means is that we see in maintaining the system. See, because we have to understand, in maintaining the system, then the point is it's the householder who does all these different duties, right? The duties of a kshatriya cannot be performed as, they're done as a grihastha. The vaishya, the shudra, this is all being done as the grihastha. So all the economic development, all the maintenance is all coming out of there. Everything's coming out of there. So then everybody else is being, how you say, maintained by the grihasthas, like that. That is the thing. So in maintenance of the system, that's it. And it's most of the bulk are there. But at the same time, because there are higher purposes to this, therefore those who are detached means you have the brahmacharis who are detached, but they are, how you say, dependent. So they are taken care of by the grihasthas. Out of, how you say, like parental affection. then the vanaprasthas and sannyas, they're detached and they're respected by the grihastha because their purpose is to get to that. So we see, therefore, in the whole system is actually, it's only Krishna is the superior, Krishna, the devotees. And whoever you are, you always consider someone else. Like Krishna, he considers that his devotees are greater than him. Therefore, it's said, what is it? Aradhananam sarvesham Vishnur aradhanam param. Then? Something tasmat paratanam devi, is it? Tadiyanam samarpanam. So, superior to all forms of worship is worship of Vishnu. But superior to that is worship of the devotees. So this is how Krishna considers it. So you'll find here is that it's gone through this and shown how the grihastha respects the sannyasi, the vanaprast, all these different things and all that. At the same time, is then it points out this note here is everybody else should understand that the grihastha is also in a position of superiority because he is supporting everybody else. The whole system is functioning because of that. There's houses to go begging to for the brahmachari, vanaprastha, and sannyasis, you know, or from the because they're grihasthas, right? You have this whole setup and all this. You have Gurukul is there. You have the teacher and the student, the brahmin and the student, because it's grihasthas, right? There's no grihasthas and there's no kids, you know. I mean, Brahma had a few without bothering with the whole system, but that was it, you know. It's interesting, just on a side point of that, is how you have the gotras. Because everybody goes back to, you know, Brahma and Krishna. But it's you take the line back to who is the rishi, all the sons of Brahma. When you say what gotra one's in, the gotra means it goes back to that particular son of Brahma. And because they're unborn, he is unborn and they're just coming from his mind and different parts of his body and all this without the normal system. Therefore, then them and their children, they can intermarry and everything like this because they're different gotras, they're different lines. Because they're coming from different mentalities, so their whole subtle and gross body are different, right? Brahma's mentality creates all the different sons. So you don't have the problem where they're brothers, so how can they marry each other's, you know, daughters and stuff like that? Because they're actually different lines. You know, it has to start somewhere. So in the household, it takes his line back to that particular rishi, and that's called the gotra. So that point is that everybody, there's something to respect about someone else. No one sits on their own. This is a very, means if one understands the Vedic principle, one sees that they respect for others and what they can gain is the most important element. So this idea that you have one person that's great and worshipable above everybody else, no one is equal, all this, it's not actually a full understanding, even on the Vedic platform. You know, means generally you'll see that with the Lord in the Vaikuntha platform, but you don't even see that with the devotees, right? Because the Lord comes himself to help the devotees and takes all these funny roles, like with Ramanuja, then Lakshmi Narayan come as a hunter and his wife, you know, which are in a, so they're kind of coming as helping him, serving him like this. So they always, this aspect is there. So the idea where we just see the spiritual master and we just, they're it. Everybody else we don't deal with properly. We don't have to deal with properly because Guru is there and don't you understand and all this. Then means one is not very deep in the understanding of the Vedic knowledge. Not very deep at all. Because here we see that whatever the position, that respect must be there. That respect must be there. That's why it said in the Kali Yuga, everything gets turned upside down. Because the grihasthas don't somehow or another make the money so much. The sannyasis, the brahmachari, they have the money. And then grihasthas then come to take from them and this and that. And it turns upside down because it should be the other way around. no matter how much opulence that the sannyasis, brahmacharis may receive, that's, the grihasthas have so much more. But in Kali Yuga, everything just to give everybody trouble, then everything starts turning around. You know? So it's like, you know, everybody gets trouble like that. 90. As all rivers, both great and small, oh, let's see. Yeah, okay. 91. By twice-born men belonging to any of these four orders, the tenfold law must be ever carefully obeyed. Contentment, forgiveness, self-control, abstention from unrighteously appropriating anything, obedience to the rules of purification, coercion of the organs, wisdom, knowledge of the Supreme Soul, truthfulness, and abstention from anger form the tenfold law. So in other words, any of the four ashrams, they are supposed to follow these ten laws. The tenfold law. This should be what everybody is working for. Contentment means that they're satisfied with whatever comes easily. They don't overly have any desires, or best is that they're not working on the platform of desire, so whatever they have, they're peaceful with. Forgiveness, because they know that nobody is the doer, so they don't see anybody as an enemy, because they don't see that anybody is actually doing anything. It's all being carried out by the modes of nature under the direction of the Lord. Happening. Self-control means that there must be, abstention from unrighteously appropriating anything means one has one's duties according to those duties, that's how one gets things. And one doesn't break, even in doing those activities, one doesn't break the law to get. Right? Like if one is doing some activity, he doesn't break any rules to get more. He just does what is proper for his duty, according to his position, as a devotee, and as a particular ashram or varna that he is situated in. Then, obedience to the rules of purification. So all the gross and subtle purifications is a very important part of human existence, because if the gross body can't be clean, you can't keep the subtle body clean. And if the subtle body is not clean, there's generally not a rise in interest in spiritual cleanliness, which means just being situated on the platform of pure devotional service. So they are, so purification is very important. So sometimes it's thought, well, okay, Brahmins have to be very clean, a sannyasi is very clean. No, everybody has to be clean. You know, well, brahmacharis and sannyasis have to be self-controlled. No, everybody has to be self-controlled. No, like that. Everybody should gain according to their method, and they should not gain otherwise. Coercion of the organs means they must all be kept in control. Wisdom. That means is the wisdom means is the realization. One gets that by association, by study. So that to gain this, there must be study, there must be proper behavior, there must be service. If there's no service, there's no realization, there's no wisdom. So that means menial service. Performance of one's duties in a proper, dutiful fashion is there. Knowledge of the Supreme Soul. So that's the jnana. Truthfulness means that one must be doing things for the purpose, pleasure of the Lord. That is truth. And abstinence from anger, because anger then it comes from the aspect of that when one has too many material desires, one can't fulfill them, one gets angry. Like that. Either at the situation, at a particular person or thing or something that has gotten in the way of one's sense gratification. 93. Those brahmanas who thoroughly study the tenfold law and after studying obey it, enter the highest state. A twice-born man who with collected mind follows the tenfold law and has paid his three of debts may, after learning the Vedanta according to the prescribed rule, become an ascetic. We discussed that before, is that debt, because that comes up in the daksha pastime, is that the debt of children is important if on the materialistic platform, but if one is on the understands the transcendental platform, then one can go straight from brahmachari to sannyas, and there's no breakage of the law. 95. Having given up the performance of all rites, throwing off the guilt of his sinful acts, subduing the organs, and having studied the Veda, he may live at his ease under the protection of his son. Okay, so this is talking here about the Bahudak here. Because this is talking about now you've done all these things, now you're moving into this sannyas ashram. So here, at his ease under the protection of a son, means they build a small hut outside the village. And then he just studies. He just sits there and studies. That's all he does. Studies, performs his activities of, you know, sadhana and cleanliness and studies. That's all he does. But this, under the protection of the sun, means the sun will bring something to eat every day. Like that. So that's the first stage of sannyas, bahudak. Then, after some time, he may go on to then, when he's studied nicely and he feels confident in this, then he goes on to kutichak, where he goes and begs in the village and then maintains himself. And then, once he's comfortable in that, then Parivrajaka Acharya, then he goes out, he leaves the village and goes out. 96. He who has thus given up the performance of all rites, who is solely intent on his own particular object, and free from desires, destroys his guilt by his renunciation, and obtains the highest state. Here, generally, always guilt means sinful reactions, or, you know, the anartas, like that. 97. Thus the fourfold holy law of brahmanas, which after death yields imperishable rewards, has been declared to you. Now learn the duty of kings. So here is also an interesting thing here, is that the grihastha ashram has been described, and now this is the grihastha ashram for everybody, though there was a particular section for snatakas, specific for the brahmins. Because the brahmins, why it would be told in relationship to the brahmana is because the brahmana, by his conditioned nature, can go through all four ashrams. Kshatriya would generally go through three, Vaishya two, Shudra one. Like that. So then, all four are described here, but those rules apply to everybody. Because the king, the Vaishya, they're also brahmacharis. They're also like that. Same time is also, if we understand the principles of devotee, then devotee is a brahmana, is an actual brahmana. Though the conditioned nature may be such that there may be occupational varna of a brahman, kshatriya, vaishya, shudra, but he follows the system of ashram according to the brahminical standard, because that's what one is. Does that make some sense? So that's been explained here. So that ends chapter 6. Yes, please.
Back a few verses, you were talking about the, you know, the different stages of sannyas.
Yes.
How the son brings the food and like,
yes,
that. What is the wife supposed to be doing during all that? I know she's obviously cooking the food that he takes out there.
Yeah.
So that's what his biggest attachment is. And the son is there. So he must be giving some kind of, you know, taking the place of the husband. But should she be still maintaining, should she divert her attention to her own spiritual life at that stage, her own,
yes,
budget, or should she still be for her own, not to become bitter or feel like because this relationship kind of goes on even after the husband.
Yeah, yeah.
That's, like he has been a kind of giving shiksha.
Yeah.
So how does that work exactly in our situation as devotees, where we have dysfunctional families that don't really work like that? particularly the wife doesn't develop a hard heart, to kind of feel like she's been ripped off, or, you know, to become bitter, because I see in our society that happens.
Yeah.
Somehow we do things in a very clumsy way.
Yeah.
And what would you suggest there in that situation?
Well, one of the aspects is it's very useful is that the vanaprastha stage, because as we discussed before, the vanaprastha stage, both the husband and wife are starting to turn their attention seriously to their own personal spiritual development. So greater sadhana, you know, taking advantage of the holy dhams, association of saintly persons, their own private personal study, own worship of the Lord, all these are naturally increased. So whatever has been going on that the wife has been doing, that naturally just continues. Now, just the husband takes the opportunity to not do that in the house and go out, and then in a position to give all that that has been gained as brahmachari, grihastha, vanaprastha, now that they can go out and give that very nicely, you know, in the traveling and preaching. But the activities of the wife at vanaprastha, that remains. So basically they remain as a vanaprastha, but they take on the mood of a recluse then. They generally kind of like withdraw into their own sadhana and their
husband
own...
Husband and wife both do that.
Yes, husband would just... The wife generally does it sitting in one place and he goes out. In other words, basically she becomes kind of more like a bhajananandi and he becomes a ghostianandi. That's basically what's going on. Though even ourselves... You know, even we're sitting in one place because we have such a nice association of devotees. Therefore, we can preach and do all these different things. And by the situation, how Prabhupada's arranged it, even sitting in one place, you can do so much. You don't have to go out to preach everybody who comes to us, especially if we're sitting in Vrindavan or Mayapur. Then that becomes very, very easy. So our preaching can go by being a recluse in the dham. So it's expected that the man goes out and travels more, because that maintains more of the purity there. But the women just become more reclusive and stay more and more out of the whole, you know, grihastha scene and all that. As vanaprasthas, they would more... That's the time when they give all their advice and tell everybody how they should do it and, you know what they shouldn't do and give that kind of advice and more close association. Though they're a little bit aloof from it, but generally the when one goes into this mode, the reclusive, then even that is kind of cut back a lot, unless it's very, you know, well-known, close people that very, without much involvement, you can help them a lot in these areas. You know, it's more in relationship to the spiritual development. You have to take care of the material side rather than just, you know, this is how you run the ashram. Does that make sense? It takes a slightly different flavor.
It's a natural, you know, progression.
It's a natural progression.
You find it distasteful.
Yeah. Yeah. So you just don't get involved in that. And they also should respect that and not expect that these others get involved. Because it'll be obvious. Those who are always around and don't mind and come and help take care of the kids, they're like grandma. So that's more just that beginning stage of the vanaprastha life. And that's not a problem. You know, because then they're kind of like, you know, the universal grandma, you know, like that. But then when they find that they will naturally come to a point where they kind of step back from that also. Because if the process is going on nicely, there's always going to be, you know, always more and more persons coming into that. Because everybody's getting older, so there's always going to be persons coming to vanaprastha. So then it's natural that... with time, then there's going to be those ladies who then they just kind of withdraw from that. And that should also very much be considered when with devotees discussing the aspects of setting up, how you say, like vanaprastha, like widow kind of ashrams, is that there's always going to be these two categories. Those who still have some or still move a bit with the grihasthas and all their things, and you know, they have whole families with, you know, oodles of kids and the whole scene coming to visit them and all that. And you're going to have those women who just don't want to get involved in that. So in creating the facility, either they should be separate facilities or the facility should be designed in such a way that those who want to meet like that can meet in a place where they don't have to go out and expose themselves outside, But those who want to be more reclusive aren't exposed to it either. You know, so there has to be something either in the ashram or something where there's kind of like in the, how you say, in the house. In the normal house is that you would have the outside of the house. This is inside the house, but the front rooms where any guests and all that come. Then you have the inside, which is called the antepordum, where that's where the women live, and then no outside people come in there. Only the men of the house, and that they may go in. But other guests, nobody goes inside there. So in the same ways, you kind of have to have some concept like that, how it's done. But it should be kept in mind as it comes up, is that they have to make that distinction. There must be some place where, if you do have that kind of guests or things happening, that it's there's a place where people can go. At the same time, it's not going to disturb those who want to, you know, do their own studies, sadhana, this and that. Otherwise, you have everybody walking everywhere. It drives you nuts, you know.
Yeah.
Like that. Plus, you're going to have naturally then many of those women. There's going to be others who want to come and hear from them. There may be an organized class where they will come to them to learn. The tradition is they don't go out to speak. People come to them. So there should be some facilities like that where people can come from outside, hear the classes, but it still doesn't bother the others that are in the ashram. You know.
I've seen that a lot in India, where the grandmother may hold up. When she does it at home, because of bhajan, and the neighbors come. Or do the Mahabharata, Ramayana.
Yeah, yeah.
And then it goes on every night.
Yeah.
She maintains that.
Yeah. No, that's very, very common. Very, very common in India. Just as that's the culture, is that everything gets done, but it just has to be known how to do it. Like sometimes the women see the men go out and speak, so we should also do. But it's not done like that. It's a much nicer flavor, is that you and your place and everybody comes there.
So it's not practical also with a woman's body. I've done it for 5 years. It's pretty.
Yeah, it's very difficult. It's those who profess it aren't actually realistic, you know, because the Vedas...
It's just not practical.
It's not practical. But when they come, it's a much more intimate atmosphere. Yeah. It's much nicer they've come and this and that. Because when you go out, maybe half the people like want to hear, half don't. But when they come to you, you know everybody's there.
Right.
So it's very comfortable. It's very comfortable, natural. You can speak very freely. And the whole thing is the mood is, the woman likes that mood of protection and kind of like, that the sanctity of that kind of like emotional atmosphere. So if they come to you, then that's there.
Yeah.
So it's going to happen because, like we've seen many times, see some of our senior god sisters and all that. When they give classes, many like to go hear it. But it's just, you create a place where then people can go there and hear and not be bothered, and you know, they don't have to be also disturbed by the formality. Like in the temple room is not a great ideal place because there's always people coming, going, you're restricted by certain times and all this. While if it's in a more private location, then you're not worried about those things. It's a controlled atmosphere. You can speak however long you want. Questions can go on however long you want. You don't have to worry about any political atmospheres and loaded questions and all that kind of craziness. You know, so it's much better. But the difference between the two is the husband has to cut off the attachment for the wife. Otherwise, if he doesn't, it's very dangerous for him. Prabhupada even mentions, I think it's in the Bhagavatam or Chaitanya Charitamrita, he writes and he talks about sannyasi, that whenever, you know, he sees his wife, he starts to cry. Like that. There's a purport where Prabhupada mentions that. He's talking about one of our god brothers who eventually went back to his wife. But the wife doesn't have to give up that attachment to the husband.
It
depends. If she can do that, means how you say the respect is. In other words, how you'd say it would be a subtle. As we described before, let's deal with the lower one than the higher one. Means, or no, let's do it the other way around. Is what is happening is that respect is there as like guru. That is there, but the aspects, if one wants the aspects of the And that protection is there through the instruction and good example. But there's no attachment to that there's going to be that direct contact and direct relationship. That will be dropped. And so then remembering them is like remembering any devotee. So remembering the Lord or anything in connection with the Lord is auspicious. Best is if you can remember the Lord or, you know, the liberated personalities. The other advantage is even if it's on the lower standing where there's still kind of the more, you know, just, common mundane attachment. But if that husband is spiritually advanced by remembering, one gets the same benefits. So whatever benefits he will get, that the wife will get by remembering. So if he remembers Krishna and goes back to Godhead, she just remembers him. Even out of just material attachment, she'll go back to Godhead. So it's kind of like a double, there's a double advantage there.
It really depends on the platform of advancement the husband's on. He's kind of a material, you know.
If he's a materialist, then you better think of Krishna.
But
even if not, then it does afford that if one is not advanced oneself, one thinks of the husband, then one will take a birth as a man.
Yeah.
And that will afford that little bit more freedom.
Yeah.
Which can be advantageous if it's used properly, but otherwise it doesn't matter, because if it doesn't use it properly, then, you know, one will think of the wife or the daughter or the mother or something, and then it'll just reverse, you know. That's why it's yeah. So it's a very, they're always very easily understood if one works on that one's not the body platform, because then all these things are very easily discussed. So it's, and yeah, that's just there. So the man also, it's not that they can't, because the point we mentioned before, no attachment or aversion. So he's not averse to the wife, because the point is that gratefulness is there. She's done so much, helped so much in the service, been such a good advisor, because there's so many times when the wife will be able to give good advice when it comes to just so many situations, especially if the husband becomes bewildered by any, you know, over material desire, then generally the wife has a tendency to be more fixed in the principles of religion, you know, like that. The man will be more kind of, intellectually fixed in religion, while the wife will be more emotionally fixed. So because of that emotion, she doesn't want to break him. She just knows it's bad. While the husband sometimes wavers, you know, well, this is this and that, and they kind of like put things together and try to make it look like it's not so bad. But then the wife points out, no, it is, and then he has to. So much of that kind of situation, and that gratefulness is there, but it's more as a devotee. But still, at the time of death, he shouldn't remember the wife like that. It's not recommended. Like that, because his remembrance will be that, like that would be out of attachment. Because it's mentioned, even Bhaktisiddhanta says, what he talked about, someone who's not qualified, who sits around and tries to remember the gopis all day, in his next life will take birth as a woman, not as a transcendental gopi, because he's just thinking, because they don't actually understand what a gopi is. Gopi is not a woman. Gopi is a pure, unalloyed devotee who has a particular love for Krishna, so that love manifests the form of a gopi. That the form of the gopi is the perfect form for that particular attachment to Krishna. But in the material world, then that attachment is because of what one, this material concept. So it's very different. Therefore, the sahajiyas and all that, they don't get an auspicious result. They're thinking of the gopis and always talking about the gopis doesn't get them the transcendental gopis, you know. So the position is there for both. It's the same thing. It's just a matter of, for the man he should go out, for the woman should stay back. It's just like Prabhupada mentioned, Gorni Thai goes out, Radha Krishna, they don't travel generally. Radha Madhava were traveling with the Calcutta Lord Chaitanya. And then they were traveling with him at Gorakhpur and all this, and then somehow or another he came to the Hyderabad program, that famous picture of him sitting on that kind of like, it's like jari and like all kinds of different squares and colors and mirrors and all that kind of, I don't know what style it is. There's a certain style of decoration. He's sitting there, and in the background you can see Lord Chaitanya and Radha Madhava. That's at the Hyderabad Pandal. So I think at that time he mentioned that Radha Krishna doesn't go out traveling, because I think they had already been sent to Mayapur and they needed Didi, so they sent them out again. But it was that he had received them, and then they were traveling with them. Because they were traveling, so there was no temple or anything. But once there was temple established in that, then he established them. Then he said that they shouldn't travel. So in the same way, like that. The men go and travel a lot, and the women sit, do their bhajan, like that. But the Dharma Shastras, they mention the word recluse, like that, which is basically the same equivalent. Is that they go into a kind of like, they just pull out of the whole social picture. They pull back and they just go into their own sadhana and associate with those who they find, you know, good association. It said, I think Bhaktivinoda Thakur mentions that the devotee, when it mentions, like in the Gita, it says one of the things of knowledge is stays away from the mass of people and all that. So that means that if there's no devotees around, then one just goes off into solitude. But if there's devotees, sincere, serious devotees, then one always associates with them. That's better. Is that if there's only materialists, then you go off alone. But if there's devotees, then you associate with them. So that's the principle. You find those who you like to associate with and associate with them, and basically restrict it to that. Forget all the social, this, that. Like that. Is that?
Yeah.
Any other questions on? Yes.
In regard to what is thinking of the husband again.
Huh.
I think previously it was mentioning that if a woman is chaste, her husband gets the same benefit as the husband.
Yeah. No, that's even in the house. Is that in the house we were reading that when she performs the household duties, she gets the same benefit of the brahmachari living in the ashram with the guru and performing all the personal service to the guru. She gets all the same benefits. So like that, I think there's two or three different aspects like that. So it's whatever the boy gained in the ashram and the gurukul, the girl gains in the home, and by serving in that home environment. So it's very well worked out. Like that they all get the same benefit, but it's just that since you have to make things work, and we're working on a paradigm where the living entity once has wanted to be God, so therefore God means his energies. So that means you create the male and female principle, like that. But in the material world, the problem is both are female, right? But at the same time, we're both are in the male mentality. So it's like it gets really weird. So the Veda is just, okay, this is the attachment. Now, you know, one of them takes, who's in the female body, uses the female mentality to get done, you know, means if they're materialistic, to accomplish the male mentality that they have of wanting to enjoy. But they do it through the female nature. And then the female who's in the male body uses the male mentality to develop the male desire to enjoy. But in this way, then at least there's cooperation and both get what they want. They both enjoy the material nature. But now, then the devotees then use this same nature to follow it to please Krishna. So the same rules that are there to make everything work because of this reflection of our wanting to enjoy the material nature, then now we use it for Krishna. We've used it for ourselves since time immemorial. Now we use it for Krishna. So that actually makes it spiritual. So now the household duties, the this, the that, aren't material anymore. They're spiritual. And by engaging in them, one gets a spiritual benefit. As long as one understands that. If one doesn't understand it, then the benefit will be very minimal. You know? Very minimal. But if one understands that, then by doing those household duties, then one gets so much benefit. Because one's doing it for Krishna. Like that, but it's just it gets very little complex there. But, you know, that's why the whole thing is it's there just to clear the illusion. And then the devotee knows, okay, the male body, male gross and subtle body has a particular nature, so therefore it has its advantages and disadvantages. So the advantages are used nicely for Krishna, and the disadvantages then are also according to Krishna's rules engaged. And then the female gross and subtle bodies have their, and you engage them there. But it doesn't matter because, as it pointed out here, it doesn't matter what the ashram you're in. Is if you follow these tenfold principles and you follow the ones before of always hearing about the Lord, you know, the philosophy, hearing about the Lord's pastimes, the position of the devotees, ourselves, and then what is our duties, then one attains to the highest platform. So with the proper devotional etiquette and with the proper philosophy and, you know, proper association, then everybody goes back to Godhead. So who cares what's the position? So it doesn't matter whether it's male or female or brahmachari, grihastha, vanaprastha, sannyas. It doesn't matter. It's all, the gross and subtle body are an illusion anyway. So why get worried over which particular illusion we're going to use in Krishna's service? You know, it's just, it's all illusion. But Krishna is so kind, he gives us ways that we can use that illusion in his service. Does that make some sense? Therefore, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, when he describes the whole Varnashram process in one of his essays, he's describing it from the platform of the Hamsa. Because the Hamsa can really take advantage of the Varnashram system. Like that. Because the Hamsa knows I'm not this body, but I am in a particular body. And I have a particular subtle body that has created that gross body. And by inspection, I see that this subtle body has these particular group of desires. And I can best engage those particular desires and the gross body that it has created in the Lord's service through this particular ashram and these particular duties of this varna. And then I do that, and one lifetime I go back to Godhead. I don't have to worry about what I go through. Just I do that for Krishna. So on that platform, then everybody's sannyas. Because everybody is engaged their duties for Krishna. So it becomes a very unique system. The Daiva Varnashram is unique, and if one engages it properly, then it becomes even more. That's why the smartas and others can't understand it at all. Because they're simply going by the born body, the gross body. But they don't understand is more than that's the subtle body, and then there's the consciousness of the soul. So situating oneself on the consciousness of the soul, then one engages the subtle and gross bodies in the Lord's service, according to the Varnashram. Because, I mean, what better way is there to engage them? Right? It's so well thought out, so planned, and it's coming from the Lord, you know, through authorities. Why we won't use that system? Why a devotee would want some other system? You know, it's so perfectly organized. So perfect, the Lord comes, he follows it himself. Like that. All his devotees who come, they follow it. And the only ones that don't follow it, we see is like the Ivantipur, I mean, even the Ivantipur Brahman was following Pariyuva Jakacharya. But, you know, otherwise Sukadev, like this, they're not really following it. But when they preach, they follow it. He followed all the etiquette of being a teacher when he's speaking to Parikit. No question that Parikit Maharaj can, you know, not listen, be inattentive, not ask questions, you know, and you know, call them names and say that he's naked and dirty and all that. You know, that, I mean, everybody else is doing that. He couldn't care less because he's acting as a Paramahamsa. He's not following any of the rules. But when he preaches, then as a taking the position of a madhyama, then the rules must be followed. But for Krishna's satisfaction. So therefore, he's given a seat, Parikit is put there, everybody else sits around and listens, and the conversation is going between them. It means here's the teacher and student, everybody else can listen. They're not asking any questions. You don't hear one person ask a question in the whole 7-day conversation. Like that, because they're the students. Everybody else has just come to watch this wonderful example of teacher, you know, transcendental example of teacher and student. Like that. Come. What is that? Oh, which one? Yellow ones or black ones? The ones the hairs come out?
Mm.
You sure? No, but they all are like that. It means both of them. The ones that the hair don't come out and the ones the hair does. Oh no, the ones that the hair doesn't grows on jute, right? Yeah. So this is the ones hairs come out. Really, they've already started. Yeah, take them out into the banana garden. Any other questions on this? Because next we get into the king. Because now the four ashrams have been described. The duties of a Brahmin have been described. So now the duties and that of the Kshatriya will be described. That's the next. Then once you've done that, basically then you have described Varnashram. The only thing left now, because Dharmashastra doesn't have to talk about business. You know? That's an art. Like that, or you know, music or something else that the artisan does. It doesn't have to talk about that. The whole Varnashram system is described with this. The details of how a Vaishya or Shudra deal will come out in the laws. Right? Because that's where, you know, especially the Vaishyas follow things. Brahmin and Kshatriya follow it because it's the Shastra. They won't do something against the Shastra. They will find the practical application within the Shastra. Right? Vaishya does whatever is practical, whether it's in the Shastra or not. So therefore, just because the Shastra thing is there that you do your duty in this way, out of duty, is not necessarily going to impress them. But as a rule of law, like civil or criminal law, that if they break it, they're going to get punished, then they can see, you know, great practicality in following it. Like that. So that then that, their duties will be described there. I mean, that aspect of the duties. In other words, in the negative, it'll be described. In the positive, all the four ashrams and the duties of a Brahmin and Kshatriya. And then in the negative, you'll get for the Vaishya and the Shudra. Does that make sense? That's why you see in the Bhagavatam, it's just talking about Brahmins and kings and devotees and like that. Because that they all work according to the scripture, according to God's law. And you don't have to describe, you know, once you know one businessman, then you know them all. Like that. Because the principle of business is the same, the art's the same. Once you know one musician, it's all the same. You know? It's just a matter of the individual's inspiration. You know, and inspiration and what else? Ingenuity, and then there's another one where they take a step. They want to do it. Initiative, yeah. Because that's all it is. Is the principles of business are the same. All businessmen are following it, but it's their initiative and their understanding of where's an opportunity for business, that is then, you know, everybody has their unique platform. So as we mentioned before, that's just the what you do to make your money. The real thing is that Vaishya is a grihastha. So when he comes back to the house and when he's dealing in his life, he's a grihastha. Therefore, the rules of the grihastha are the most important. The rules of business are secondary. You know, the king is described because even though it's secondary, it's that is by him doing that, the whole society is protected, so everybody can follow their varnanashram nicely. And the Brahmin, because he has to instruct everybody like that.
You were talking about the 10 laws earlier.
Huh.
Is there a difference between using anger and being angry? Like sometimes when you're dealing with very tamagun mentality and a really thick mentality, sometimes you really need to
The anger that is meant is that is very detrimental. That is anger that is springing from a frustration of desire. Is that we have a desire, it's not being fulfilled, we get angry. Like that, for ourselves. So that's not good. You know, we wanted a position, we don't get it, we get angry. We want someone to do something, you know, and then we'll get some benefit out of it, they don't do it, we get angry. You know, we have a desire we want, we can't get it, we become angry. You know, either at a person or a situation, both, or like that. But the anger used against non-devotional mentalities or activities, as long as it's just for that and not for our own position and all that, then that's not bad. Narottam Das Thakur, in one of his songs, he mentions that all this lust, greed, envy, anger, illusion, all that, attachment, will all be, he'll engage them all in Krishna's service. Like that. So greed, he'll be very greedy to always hear subject matter about Krishna. And then attachment, he'll be, you know, try to develop his attachment from Krishna and his devotees and anything in relationship with him. Anger, he'll use that against those who are opposed to devotional service. Like that. So in this way, then they'll be engaged. Anything else? Yes. Speak a little louder.
They mentioned something about doing things in a legitimate way, in order to build up dharma.
Yeah.
Sometimes devotees may want to serve Krishna, and in the name of serving Krishna, they can say, well, it's transcendental. So if I steal thousands of dollars worth of flowers, for example, then that's okay.
I mean, something like that only works if it is for Krishna. But if there's other ways to get it, why one will do that? Right? If there's proper ways of doing something, why one will use such a system anyway? You know? So it's one has to really think about that. I mean, it's because there's one has to see what is behind that. You know? That's the whole point, is that in principle we can see, like there was a conversation Prabhupada was discussing about the moralists and in distributing a book, and some lady asks, does this book deal with, you know, some... the power crisis, right? So then the devotee says, yes, and she buys the book and reads it and later comes back and says, hey, this doesn't have anything to do with the power crisis. So then some will say this is morally wrong. But the point is that the real morality is in connection with Krishna. And the lady should be hearing about Krishna and understanding he's the source of power. And if there's any shortage of power, it's because we're not understanding where the power is coming from. So he hasn't really told, but it's on a higher platform. She's thinking it's on a lower platform. But they've gone over the lower and into the higher platform, just like Narad Muni preaching to the sons of Daksha. The Haryasvas? That he preaches in them is that, you know, they said, well, our father said we must do this, you know? And he says, yes, that's exactly the point. You must do what your father says. So your real father is Krishna. Like that. He's the father of Brahma. Brahma's then of Daksha and Daksha of yourself. But the real has come from, because the soul, you, have come from Krishna, not from Daksha. He's given you the body. So you must follow what your real father says. So that's the practice of devotional service, go back to Godhead. So they did that. So he didn't break Dharma. Dharma says you must respect the mother and father. But the point is that higher platform of the real mother and father. You know? That Krishna is the mother and father, or the spiritual master in the Vedas. Like this, that they're the real mother. And then those who have biologically given us life, you know, I mean this body, get the opportunity for us to reside in this particular form, then they are also respected, but in that order. You know, so first comes the spiritual personalities, the Lord and the Lord's representatives, you know, and the scriptures. Then after that comes the parents. Because even the Dharma Shastras just say you must respect the parents, they always put them down, they always put them on that lower platform. Respect for the teacher, one who gives the spiritual knowledge, they're 100 times more respectful than the biological parents.
But isn't there an influence of Mayavadism in that behavior by devotees, in that mentality by devotees, that everything belongs to Krishna, I'm Krishna's servant, so I can use everything as I want?
It can be if they're not seeing it in a personal way. The difficulty comes is that is they could do it some other way, but it's just easier. You know, you can go out and collect a few flowers that way in a few minutes. You know, it may be also a little bit more exciting. You know, while the other one, you have to go out and do something, you know, more proper or something. And they don't want to, you know, they'd rather sit around and talk for jalpa or something. Second is they may get more, people may appreciate more, they get more respect themselves. Like this, you have to see what's there inside it. That's the whole thing. But the principle is that whatever's in connection with Krishna is transcendental. So philosophically that is there, but then one has to see there is the application of the philosophy. Right? And that's Abhideya. So we have to see that the Abhideya is proper.
Isn't part of that principle of application, understanding that anything that's taken improperly from the cosmos is taken back by the cosmos within 11 years?
Means is that if there is no other alternative, means then these things may happen. But otherwise, if there is, why these things will go on? So one has to see that, because there's normal duties and then there's also, you know, the abnormal situations. Like that. So then one has to see the situation. It depends also on the individual. Because it's like this, one may say, okay, then we don't have any flowers for Krishna and it's Janmashtami, so we go out and collect some. So that's, one can look at it from that side and that can be okay. But at the same time is that the need of such elaborateness and something big like this is also an aspect of just externally one needs to see that, otherwise one thinks nothing's happening. But otherwise someone advanced can also just by other things that don't require all that, you know, some special bhajans for Krishna or their fasting or extra japa or reading or whatever they can put together with whatever facility they can do, and that's done with devotion, then that's very wonderful. That's why Krishna says, patram pushpam phalam toyam. Generally, you can always get something of that. You can't get it some flowers, you can get some water or some fresh leaves. Even just fresh leaves, you know, the new leaves that are lighter, the lighter colored leaves than that, or fresh grasses. Anything that's fresh, then that can be offered if you have nothing else. You know, then ultimately there's tulsi leaf. Even if you had just one tulsi leaf, that's enough. You know? Like, even if it's dry and all that, doesn't matter. So then through that can be done. You know? But then if there's some big preaching and lots of people and then you just have somebody sitting there with one tulsi leaf, it may not, you know, make great copy in the, you know, local, whatever it is. So then sometimes, you know, normally unused situations might be taken advantage of because it's being done for that purpose. But if it's if it But one has to just see in oneself that it's not being used for one's own purposes. You know, to show everybody how wonderful a worship that we have done. Like that. The pride in that we have done something bigger than anybody else. Mm-hmm. Like that. Does that make some sense? Mm-hmm. Yes. A little louder.
In the Deity Worship book, there's a quote which says that stolen flowers can't be offered.
What?
It says that
stolen flowers
should not be offered. Yeah, because it's that would be the normal thing, you know, because then it disturbs other people and this and that, because the whole thing is the Lord's taking the whole picture into consideration, because He's the Lord of everything. So the person's garden, let's just like you have your next door neighbor and they have some wonderful flowers and then you go and steal them all. They've grown the flowers because they want to look at them. So when they come out and find there's no flowers there and they know that there were flowers there, they came out in the morning expecting to see them open and then they find them gone, then they're going to be feeling very bad and this and that and be cursing whoever it is that's done it. So that's not that pleasing to Krishna. You know? So like that, it's the principle is that in doing you shouldn't disturb other living entities. Though sometimes in preaching and speaking the absolute truth, people become disturbed. You know, but that's a bit of what can you do, you know, in that case. There's not a whole lot you can do about that. But otherwise, if that can be avoided, one does. You know, why bother?
Those flowers
are
enjoyed by those people also before
they
get to Krishna.
Yeah. That's fair. Also, you know, some more. It's yeah. Well, in other words, these things are generally avoided. You know, because of that bigger picture. You know, they say, well, we've engaged their flowers. That's there, but generally, the person that's flowers were, but may not have gotten so much benefit. The flower itself got the benefit, but the person who they belong to may not, because of their bad feelings. You know? So before they were just a materialist who liked flowers. Now they're a materialist who is cursing devotees. So now the whole idea of the deity worship is to spread the Lord's mercy to the conditioned souls. So now you've turned someone against that. So then how is that? How is that preaching? Yeah.
Usually like those people don't mind to give them if you ask them.
Yeah. Means that going ask. Because even if there, it's like even they just give one in their whole lifetime, they're benefited. You know, and if that's all the more they can do, fine. At least that one has been, you know, you just send some, you know, nasty person, send some cute kid over there, some, you know, nicely dressed lady and just say, oh, you have such nice flowers, can you give one? You know, and then they'll get and they'll happily give that. So you've engaged them if that was the purpose, like that, and then go find flowers somewhere else. What time is it? 7:12. Any other questions or what? Yes.
In the purport for Srila Prabhupada's book, he says that ladies who are widows, they can either engage in Nishkam activities or worship the deities alone.
Hmm.
And of course, with this kind of devotees, we've also been instructed by Prabhupada that we worship our own deities when we're in the vicinity of the temple that may be distracting from the main temple.
Hmm.
Yet at the same time, it could be because a woman alone might find comfort in doing that, at least at a certain stage, because she can't really participate in the same way as kind of impersonal with thousands of people competing, doing bathing and dressing.
Yeah.
Could you comment on that as far as how the benefit? I've also heard that if you like Hindus, they worship the family deity, they may take birth in the same family out of attachment to that deity to continue that performance, which we don't want to do, but maybe speak a little bit about that.
Yeah.
How to do it.
Means when one takes second initiation, then the fifth aspect of Panchasamskara is yaga, which means receiving the right to worship the deity. And with that, you generally get a deity. Like you find many times in the initiations that in there Prabhupada will make some reference to the deities that are there, of the initiates. He will mention about it, worship the deities, or here is Krishna, you know, worship Krishna. Though the deities will, devotees will just take it as just, oh yes, you know, we worship Krishna. They didn't take it specifically. But this is the element of yaga, is that one is given the right to worship the deity, and one receives the deity to worship. So as a preaching mission on ourselves, then generally we have the temple deities, and everybody doesn't keep their own because we're so much going out. Why you find, like in the Ramanujas and that, they take initiation, they get a deity, and they sit in their house and worship. So now, if the facility is there, that the temple situation is nice, and one feels and one can get involved in there, and one has that attachment to the deities there, then that would be, you know, sitting down at one's house and worshipping one's deity, because the house is Krishna's house and one's worshipping the deity. But if, like you mentioned there, you know, it's a big community, there's a lot happening, and you got to, you know, fight for it and this and that. And it's, you know, you can dress, you know, one day this in the morning, and then the next week once in the evening, and then you can do this one artik here and then like that. Then one may find as a regular sadhana, one may have one's own deity for such a situation. It means it wouldn't be so much recommended for a younger person. But in this situation where you have a renounced woman, who that's, you know, her situation, especially if the husband's gone off, taken sannyas, or he's always out traveling, the vanaprastha, and he's always out, then they might find they have that inclination to worship the deity, because then they start to see that Krishna is the actual shelter, Krishna is the real husband. He's the real shelter, the real protector, the real one giving the facilities. So all those things that were there in the mind, you know, before and during marriage, that one was, you know, kind of like seeing as an ideal to get from the situation, one starts to see that this is coming from Krishna. So that's then very nice. But one should also see that this doesn't, if there is facilities, service that one can do in the temple and preaching and other aspects, one, it shouldn't be done to the exclusion of that. Yeah. You know, in other words, you don't sit down and do a 5-hour puja in the morning. You know, when you do have other things that you could do. Yeah. If you don't have anything else to do, you do, you know, 24-hour puja is fine. But it's just one should try to strike a balance there between whatever facilities for preaching or other activities are there or not, right. And then the worship. And on that, in the family deity, in the Hindus, then that would more likely be that there's the tradition that we worship this deity, and the duties of who's going to take care of the worship of the deity. So it's kind of like I think Prabhupada tells a story that there was a devotee in Jagannath Puri who used to bring water every day to the deity. And then when he was older and all this and been doing so much of his life, I think he slipped and fell or something and hit his head. And as he was dying, he was thinking, well, who's going to bring the water?
Uh-huh.
Right? So then naturally then you take birth again to bring the water. He should have been thinking about that I'm bringing this water for Krishna and think of Krishna. So in worshipping the deity, if you're thinking of Krishna, because the point is it's his pastime, it'll be taken care of. Or if one's worried about that, then one makes sure before that one's already asked somebody that, you know, that they will receive the deities after one leaves. So then one would just think of Krishna, one doesn't have to worry. But that particular worship here, because you're thinking I'm doing it, but this is the opportunity that we can take part, because Lakshmi Sahasra Satasam Brahmasevimanam. There's hundreds and thousands of Lakshmis that are worshiping Krishna. But out of his kindness, he comes as the archer to accept our service. But otherwise, his service is already going on. He just wants us to come and take part, and this is how we can see. We can see the deity. Then we can worship. that make any sense? So then we'll end here. Om Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Srila Prabhupada ki. Tomorrow we start chapter 7, which is about the king.